Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to No Filter, where we have candid conversations about sex and faith. Sex, gender, sexuality, sexual behavior, all of it. I'm Karen Peter, and our guests today are familiar to Project Zion listeners. They are Josh and Brittany Mengelson, who also host Project Zion podcast. So hi, Josh. Hi, Brittany.
Hello.
Well, it's morning, and we're all suffering from that this morning. But I think our topic might get interesting, and that will take some of the lethargy out maybe of my personality this morning. So we're going to talk today about your experiences growing up in a faith tradition that has within it a rigid set of modesty codes and behavioral expectations. So we're just going to jump right in, if that's okay, and let's talk about that. Let's talk first about being female in that tradition. What is it like to grow up with this rigid set of modesty?
Yeah, so I first just want to mention that Mormon adults, when they go through the Mormon temple, they start wearing garments, which are basically underwear that go to your knee, and then they have a cap sleeve. So it's like a t-shirt and long shorts. And so modesty for adults is a big deal, but that trickles down to children. So there's a lot of expectations on preparing to go to the temple. And so for me, I was a young child, this idea of making sure that your clothing reflected the future temple garments that you would wear was a big deal. So there was a lot of messaging that came through various lessons or various discussions at camps or conferences, etc., that would talk about looking at your wardrobe, and we would be reminded of, well, you know, you're going to be going through the temple in a few years, so do you really want to have to get rid of all of your clothing, or how would it be to just already be dressing as if you're wearing temple garments? And so that idea of preparing yourself to go to the temple was very strong with me growing up. And so because of that, I was always questioning what I wore. I was judgmental towards what other people wore, because if they were in the same church as me, if they were supposed to be preparing for the same temple experience, then why weren't they dressing like they were preparing for it? And with that came a lot of talk of protecting yourself. Modesty was tied to protection. So not drawing attention to yourself, the boys would leave you alone if they couldn't see cleavage or too much of your thigh or your shoulders, etc. So this idea that your body was going to be consumed by your husband later, and so you needed to protect it, was very strong. And so you were safeguarding yourself, and you were preparing for your temple covenants. So those were kind of the two main reasons that I was taught for modesty, which was kind of high pressure. This idea that if I got unwanted attention from boys, then maybe it was because I was wearing something that provoked that. Or maybe I wasn't taking my faith seriously because I wasn't preparing myself to go through the Mormon temple like I should be with that outward expression of modesty.
So always in the back of your mind.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially I would guess as you entered puberty, and junior high age tends to be the age where you begin to notice the opposite sex and more pressure as you got older.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the idea of marrying young is alive and well in Mormonism. So this idea of in just a few short years, you're going to be making these covenants. So why are you wearing booty shorts now? And, you know, those kinds of things. It was definitely seen as a test of your commitment and a test of your faith to God, how you treated your quote unquote temple, which is language that's used with bodies. Yeah, it was all seen as just a commitment to God.
So Josh, I'm assuming that wearing booty shorts wasn't the issue growing up male. So what was it like to experience the modesty codes from your perspective?
Men have different set of roles. It's not so much about drawing the other sex, so female, to inappropriate thoughts per se, although I do want to say that there is a history of that. So going back to a book called Miracle of Forgiveness, Spencer Kimball talked about not what, like mowing the lawn or being outside for a man without his shirt on. So there is a component to it, but it wasn't nearly as expressed, definitely not on like a every other week basis for men at church. So like the messaging is there, but it's not nearly as prevalent. It's more for men about how well you look put together. So basically, I like to think of movie quotes. To go back to a movie called Hook, you have Peter Pan, or Peter Panning, I guess. He drops down and he has a bunch of shrubs all wrapped around him. And the one boy says, "Who's the shrub?" And I wanted to say, like in Mormonism growing up, you didn't want to look like a shrub, I guess. You just wanted to look put together. And then I also remember, like, when I was preparing for a mission, going to a ward meeting where modesty was talked about, and this one woman went let off about baggy pants. And this was back 2003, so the 90s had just finished, and baggy pants was a no-no for guys for some reason, especially, like, sagging pants. Like, pull those pants up. Don't wear baggy pants. And I don't know why that was like the biggest concern. But yeah, it's just basically clean cut, put together, clean shaven, short hair. I think in a lot of ways, men are a lot more uniform in Mormonism than even women. And I think it stems back to wider American culture. From what I understand, men got the suit, coat, and pants from military. Like, how can we make all these people in the workplace look uniform in white collar jobs? And so they copied a pattern that looked more militaristic that all men could be put in. But then when women, through second wave feminism, started entering the workplace a lot more, it hasn't been so cut and dry as it has been for men. But there's a copy over that from Mormonism with men, is that they all wear white shirts, ties. They all look the same.
Black suits.
Black suits or dark muted suits. So like dark blue, coffee colored suits.
So while you do movie, Josh, I do television. So they all look like Ward Cleaver when he comes home from work, right? So in listening to you to kind of explain what that's about, it sounds like for males, it's more about grooming. It's more about looking tidy and groomed and put together. Women, it's more about covering up. So there is a underlying sexual undertone, if you will, to the women's modesty that's not there with the male modesty.
Yeah, and I will say that women do not as explicitly get grooming tips, but there have been Mormon apostles that have told women to put on a little bit of lipstick, or that only one pair of earrings is acceptable. And so those things are kind of also seen as a test of fellowship, as a test of faith, etc. Just a lot of control.
Okay. So growing up in Community of Christ in the early 1960s, I would say that there were those kinds of conversations that took place unofficially, you know, the parking lot conversations or the after potluck conversations, but they didn't have anything to do with the religious tradition. It had everything to do with kind of Midwestern values hitting the West Coast and the dynamic that happens in that. Since I grew up on the West Coast, I can remember somebody all aghast that a woman in the congregation had pierced her ears, and the woman was probably in her 30s at the time. I remember that was quite the deal. So what has been your experience then in Community of Christ? Have you encountered modesty conversations or unwritten, if you will, modesty expectations?
So this was one thing that I was really interested in when I was, you know, quote unquote, investigating Community of Christ or seeking Community of Christ. I wanted to know what was taught about modesty because it was so ingrained to me growing up. And there was such a heavy, it was just such a heavy standard and responsibility. To me, again, that was part of my faith to God, my devotion to God. And so I didn't know how it played over in Community of Christ without temple ritual and garments, et cetera. And so I remember those were some of the early conversations that I had with my congregational leaders. And it was interesting because they knew what I was talking about. They knew, they understood the concept of modesty, but to have it be framed as a sign of faith is just not something that's in Community of Christ. No one sits then looks at a minister who is wearing a sleeveless dress and questions their ministry based on the sleeves. And so understanding that and understanding that that modesty does not necessarily mean inches of clothing was really transformative for me. So last year I was able to go to Spectacular, which is a week-long youth camp in Lamoni, Iowa that has sports and leadership and arts, etc. So they're, the kids are doing a lot of different activities. And some of the kids, you know, they're playing volleyball, so they're wearing volleyball shorts, or they're out doing water activities or playing soccer, etc. And so the dress was very appropriate for what they were doing. And length of shorts was not necessarily a big topic of conversation. And to see teenagers interact with each other in a respectful way, and I'm sure that Spectacular, Spec is not perfect, obviously. Kids are going to, you know, be kids and be judgmental and give unwanted attention, boys and girls. But to see campers and youth just respect each other in a way that I would not have seen happen growing up at a youth camp or a youth experience where boys and girls were intermingling together. So that was interesting for me to just kind of see it play out, because being taught that if you wear a tank top around a boy, you're going to get unwanted attention. And then to see a ton of youth wearing tank tops around boys and it was okay. And they just knew how to be respectful of each other was just really, it was just a good visual for me to see that completely went against, you know, what I was taught growing up.
So I think I have mentioned this before on different podcasts, but I didn't think that I had encountered any kind of rigid modesty codes in Community of Christ. But then I was flabbergasted to hear, I guess, that we do have them. They're simply localized rather than centralized.
Mm.
So I hear of camps where girls can't wear two-piece bathing suits. They have to wear a t-shirt over them because apparently nobody's ever heard of a wet t-shirt contest. So apparently a t-shirt over a bathing suit in the pool is acceptable, but the two-piece bathing suit alone is not. Those kinds of localized rules are, I guess, I don't even have a word for them because I'm just speechless by the fact that somebody would think that was an appropriate way to address female clothing at camp. So what is the kind of middle ground, if you will, localized modesty rules in Community of Christ get pretty out there to the point where if a unmarried woman, young adult woman has had a child and then later wants to come to camp as a counselor, she's not able to in a jurisdiction because it would send the wrong message. So we have some extremes that happen based on modesty because we have a vacuum of what's appropriate and what's not. So what do you think about that? What is appropriate?
I'll say that, you know, some of those stories are pretty unfortunate, I think. You know, we're all susceptible to our own biases and opinions and different local cultures. But what I think would maybe help us move beyond this are things like our enduring principles and worth of all persons, and teaching unity in diversity, because cultural differences come into play huge here. I mean, I speak very much from a Utah perspective, which is its own special bubble. But then, you know, if we think of even more broadly in the U.S. or even more globally, what I would consider modest would be completely different from somewhere else in the world. And so I think that we have the language like grace and generosity and worth of all persons to really uphold the value of each human being And you know, I also want to lift up that when we assume that because of what a girl wears to the swimming pool, that all the boys will be running after her, that's not upholding the worth of our boys either. You know, we're kind of pegging them and shaming them and making them feel like they're just these animals that need to be controlled. And so not only are we controlling the women, the young women, the girls, or the adult women, but I think it also kind of throws our men under the bus in a very, very unfortunate way, let alone completely erases like non-binary or the LGBTQ community. You know, where do they fit into all of this, like men and women, binary language of modesty? I think that we in Community of Christ have ways around this. Responsible choices is another huge one. And I think that there is merit in maybe dressing appropriately for the situation. I mean, I'm not going to wear a raincoat and a rain boots to the swimming pool. But you know, to dress appropriately for whatever situation, is happening. And just to, I don't know, I don't want to like sound too crass, but just to get over it. I mean, if a girl's wearing a bikini, is it really that much different than a skin tight one piece swimming suit? I mean, to me, there's very, very little difference. And just to understand that, you know, a lot of clothing is there for functional reasons, and to maybe try to shed our own biases and to just let the decision be with the person who's wearing the clothes. And if they're comfortable with it, then maybe our discomfort says more about us than it says about whoever's wearing the clothing.
So Josh, you are a parent of both girls and a boy. So what does modesty look like as a parent? As a dad, what is important to you when you think about your kids getting older and dealing with what is appropriate and not appropriate to wear?
So I've been thinking about this topic. Our kids are still relatively young, and they are still part of the culture that we're raising them in. So they have school standards of what they can and cannot wear, and it's relatively rigid to maybe other places in the United States, maybe not the Bible Belt, but for other places, yeah, it's kind of rigid. And I've just been thinking about the topic of modesty, and I know this episode is specifically about sex, but modesty has so much more to do than with just sex. Pulling up dictionary.com, it says modesty is the quality of being modest, freedom from vanity, boastfulness, etc. 2, regard for decency of behavior, speech, dress. So dress is only one component. And I have to ask myself, what are people doing by the way they dress? And I don't want to say that everything that I grew up with was crap, because it's not. There are some useful applications for it. You don't want to draw unnecessary attention to yourself in unhealthy ways. But the underlying reason for modesty is you're seeking value and worth through different tools that are inappropriate. And sex is one component. The other two main components would be money and power. You are looking for worth as a standing against other people based on how you look, based on what you can buy, and based on the positions that you can put yourself in the community, whether that be political or otherwise. And for my kids, what I would say is I would go back to the enduring principle of the worth of all persons. I get that people want to be desirable. I get that they want to be worthy of other people within a society. But as a faith, I want them to already have the inherent and inestimable worth of God, that they wouldn't need to go look to validate themselves in any of those three ways from other people. So like when it comes down to what people are wearing, it's the underlying desire of why they're wearing it. If somebody's wearing a strapless shirt, but they're not doing it specifically to draw unwanted attention, it's just the functionality of it. It doesn't matter, right? So it comes down to why are they doing it? Are they looking to be seen as valuable or desirable? And I get that people want to be put together and or well-groomed or whatever to be respectable, but that shouldn't be like the underlying reason for it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. It shines a different light on, I think it's James and John who are fighting over who's the greatest, and Jesus turns around and it's like, wait a minute, you could say that that is a conversation not just about humility, but about modesty. Right?
Right.
You don't try to gain validation through power, through place. Good points. I appreciate that. So when we talk about modesty in all aspects of that, especially being female, if we're going to talk about power, there is an imbalance of power between men and women, which I think sometimes leads women to try to find power in other ways. If they can't find it in the workplace, can't find it in relationships, they'll try to find it in wherever we can. So how do you then approach female empowerment without somehow crossing over into this idea that how I dress or how I act is the only way for me to experience power as a female?
I think it's tricky because this also intersects with consumerism as well. Because a lot of times what I see in Utah is if people are dressing modestly, and I say that again with kind of this temple garment in the back of my mind. So they're wearing clothing that goes to the knees and clothing that covers their shoulders. They kind of, a lot of women will substitute that with more consumerism. So instead of being able to show more skin, they will, there's just a strong sense of keeping up with the Joneses here. Fashion trends are very, very strong. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, Mormon mommy bloggers is what they call them. And they're always just pumping out new things to buy, new recommendations, things like that. And so that's kind of been interesting to me to see women kind of take claim of not necessarily their physical bodies in the way that I think some of them might want to. And I watch a lot of this dialogue online. And so I know that they get shamed if they aren't wearing their garments, like if it's very clear that they aren't, or they'll get called out for spending $200 on a pair of pants. But I have to wonder how much of that is pushing against this rigid modesty standard. And so, you know, and I don't mean to sound like stereotypical, but I think that if we can divorce power from anything related to our bodies, and just really turn it back to what's in our mind and what's in our heart. So I guess that's not stereotypical, it's cheesy. that's where I want to see the power come from. I want to see women actually use their voice and use their brains and their heads, and get their ideas out more than pimping out a $200 pair of pants. Which again is kind of what like the new fashion trend, I guess, would be like people, when I was growing up, we would wear booty shorts. Yeah. So that's the new way that they're kind of pushing against the trends, that I think that women feel suffocated by. And so for me, modesty was very much a disempowering thing. I wore temple garments for five, 6 years. And when I finally took them off, when I left Mormonism and joined Community of Christ, it completely changed my entire world. It changed how I viewed my body. It changed how I interacted with the world. It felt like this cloak of patriarchy was being taken off of me, which is not the experience of everyone who leaves Mormonism, but it definitely was mine. And so I want to be respectful, and I know that there's other religions outside of Mormonism that have strict modesty, especially for women. And some women do claim to be empowered by that. But I was never in that camp, and I never felt like I could really develop myself and find other ways to empower myself, because that was just on me all the time. So that's just my experience with it.
Josh, you have any comment to add to that?
Yeah, enforced modesty is ultimately to control people. And when it's more focused on women, you have to say that it does focus on controlling women and there is an imbalance. But patriarchy isn't something that just affects women. It affects both sexes and it does control men, and men have to play by the rules as well. I don't know where I was going with that, but...
Well, while you're thinking about it, I want to skip back to something, Brittany, that you said at the towards the beginning of our conversation when you were talking about LDS, you were judgmental about people who did not dress in your mind appropriately. And that leads us into kind of the flip side of modesty. And that is where people who are living in what they can consider to be an appropriate or modest way, how they then view and judge other people. Where is the, I mean, in a way, it almost feels like this is enforcement. This is like kind of like shunning. This is how you enforce modesty, is there's body shaming. There's the term used now is slut shaming, people who do not conform. So what does that say about modesty when it brings out these kinds of reactions, judgment, body shaming, slut shaming out of others?
Yeah, I think that it's a really important component to this to talk about, because not only does this attitude impact just the way that two humans interact with each other, but we also see it play out on a more global or national scale when we think of situations like Brock Turner or Judge Kavanaugh, or, you know, all these stories that are happening. The questions that arise are, you know, what was she wearing? What was she drinking? What was she doing? Why was she alone? Why was she out at night? And it does reinforce that idea that women can protect themselves by what they're wearing, which is absurd. I mean, if that was really credible, then no religion that upheld modesty as a high standard would have issues like rape or abuse or assault. And we know that at schools like BYU, Mazer Hill is one of the hills on campus, and it's known as Rape Hill. And that's literally what students know it by. And there's a huge, steep set of stairs that go up. And I remember there was a campaign when I was in high school. I grew up in Provo, just a few blocks south of BYU, and there was a big campaign to get that hill more lit at night, just to have more lights, because there were so many rapes that were happening on that hill. Girls would literally get picked off of the steps and would be assaulted. And yet, everyone on BYU is required to dress as if they were wearing temple garments. And so if we... you know, look at these attitudes of body shaming and slut shaming, really, is what we're particularly talking about here. It doesn't hold any water. You know, the abuse of women who are dressed extremely modestly in Islamic religions and communities, you know, there would be, if modesty really did protect you, there would be none of that. And so this idea of what was she wearing or what was she drinking, et cetera, to me just scapegoats the issue. And again, kind of throws the men under the bus. It divorces them from all accountability and makes it seem like they're just all predators ready to pounce, and women have to just guard themselves and protect themselves, which is not fair to either gender.
Right. And I think the divorce of accountability is what actually drives it up. Because when we look at sexual dimorphism, so you're just going to inherently be attracted to the people that you're attracted to. It doesn't matter what they're wearing. And to when you divorce yourself from the accountability of it, then it's just going to happen regardless of what they're wearing. And Brittany brought up certain countries where they're covered head to toe, and that's the highest areas of rape in the world. So we can look at more extreme examples as a total failure when it comes to protecting women,
but successful when it comes to controlling women.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the reality there. So when I get together with my female friends, if we're out shopping or if we're just hanging out and talking about clothing, and we're let's say we're trying clothes on, if I put on a blouse I'm not too sure about, well, I will ask my friend, does this show too much cleavage? Because too much cleavage in my line of work would be inappropriate, right? I would need to be modest. And so I'm going to look to my female friend and say, what do you think? Or is this too tight? Or is this too whatever? Do men, Josh, talk about those things? Do men like turn to other men and go, hey, do I look too hunky in this outfit that I might like inadvertently attract a female?
Never.
Never. Do men have conversations about modesty or about sexual behavior?
Yeah, I work in a blue collar job in the mine, so you can expect the sort of people I work with, and they're all male. So I am in a situation where I get to hear conversations, so I don't want to minimize it. Locker room talk is what's been thrown out, you know. I get to be put in situations where men talk about things that they wouldn't talk about if other people were present. And the conversation's not about themselves, it's about women. Okay. And usually the conversations can get very crass.
That's disheartening.
Yeah, it is. So that, however, is the reality. And it's not just in blue collar jobs. I've been in situations in ministry where I've been around a group of male colleagues and had it go south pretty fast. And the comment made, well, we shouldn't be talking about this because Karen's sitting here, and somebody else made the comment, oh, she won't care. She's all right. She won't care. And so being put in the position of either being considered all right, right? One of the guys, Karen's cool, and not saying anything, or being the bitch and saying, this is not all right. This is an inappropriate conversation. So it's not just blue collar situations.
Yeah.
So how then do you teach male responsibility for their own conduct, their own management of hormonal fluctuations? That's the nicest way I've ever put that in my life. And how do you teach that the young men?
Yeah, this is a tough topic. Like, it almost puts you in a spot like where I don't have all the answers, you know.
And so maybe part of what we can take from this, because this is a tough spot, is maybe this is something we should be talking about. Maybe, especially in light of our national conversation right now about interactions between men and women, about sexual assault, about body shaming. I mean, that's all over Facebook and Instagram. So how do we then, as a faith community, begin to talk about this in healthy ways, like you said, Brittany, in affirming ways, and make it a part of our community conversation? Because to think that it does not happen in community of Christ would be naive.
Naive. Right?
Yeah. I think one approach that I've tried to take with my kids is they are very well aware of what consent is. On an age appropriate level. So I don't make my kids hug anyone, whether that's grandma, whether that's anyone at church, etc. And you know, I've put myself in uncomfortable situations with various people that we love dearly, that will go to my kids for a hug, and sometimes my kids jump in their arms and other times they're like, no. But if the adult says like, oh, just give me a hug or let me give you a kiss, I usually will step in and say like, they're not feeling that right now, you know, like I don't make my kids give hugs or anything. And I'll usually try to say, do you want to give them a high five? And then my kids are like, yeah, and they'll do the high five. But my kids know that if they don't have to give physical affection, if they don't want to, and same with Grant, you know, my little 4-year-old son, he knows that if he wants to give somebody a hug and they say no, like, then that's no. And it doesn't mean they hate you, and it doesn't mean you're not friends with them, et cetera. It just means they're not feeling like giving hugs right now. And that seems like a really simple thing, but it's one of the simple things that can start really young that I hope will have a positive impact on them as they go into young adulthood. Mm-hmm. That they're not entitled to receive anyone's physical affection and that they don't have to give anyone physical affection if they don't want to.
Is there anything that you'd like to see as far as curriculum or discussion helps or anything like that for kids, whether little kids, the kind of tween years kids or teens, to navigate appropriate interaction and personal responsibility and healthy body image and all the things we've been talking about?
I personally would love to see that. I feel like because we left such a rigid system that had it all spelled out in very visual line item ways, going from that to then just this blanket responsible choices has been a little overwhelming for me as a parent.
Because liberation.
It would be really easy. Yeah, like it would be really easy to just kind of fall back and be like, no, children, you have to do this and you have to wear this. And if you don't, you're not pleasing God. Like as a parent, having that amount of control, like it, I hate to say it, but it's kind of tempting. But I recognize the issues with that. And so I'm glad that I'm not in that system anymore. But, you know, it would be nice to maybe have something as far as just some sort of conversation starter that would intertwine things like Brené Brown's work on shame, and, you know, consent and things like that, that I think are conversations that can start young and that can be really empowering for both boys and girls. And again, that would include the queer community, because I think that they often get left out of this conversation, especially the non-binary. So, you know, what does it look like when you as a kid don't necessarily feel like you fit in the stereotypical gender expectations? My girls are both very much tomboys. Not that that's the same as being non-binary, but sometimes they struggle with being in situations with a lot of other girls that are wearing big bows or dresses, et cetera, because my girls are like, let's go play some football. And, you know, they've got like holes in their jeans and don't own a single bow and haven't in years. So how can we just be more inclusive and affirming to all styles, all genders, ages, et cetera, while upholding the worth of everyone? Which again, I feel like we have that language in Community of Christ already. It's just maybe not as fleshed out as me, as a parent would like it to be. But maybe that should be easy.
We need some of the tools. We have the language, but we need the tools. Josh, you look like you're ready to say something.
When it comes to little kids, I think it's also wise, I don't have all the answers for this by no means, but when we're looking at little kids, we can't expect them to approach any subject with the amount of nuance. And when it goes to, as far as stages of faith theory are concerned, or how a person develops through life, we can't expect them to approach life the same way we do. And sometimes with kids, something a little bit more rigid. And I don't want to be like to the, what's the happy balance, right? But something a little bit more, this is the rule. We're just going to hang to the rule for right now. We'll talk about it at a different time. Come up with rules that can work for your kids for the time being. And then revisit the conversation later when they're able and ready to take on that new information at the time of development that they would be.
Yeah.
And usually each kid's different. Each kid develops at a different rate, but you can usually tell when the kid's ready to process something else.
So teaching basic things to little kids, no means no, right?
Right.
Those aren't mandatory. Those kinds of basic pieces of information and basic rules would be really helpful. So we started simply talking about modesty, and we've kind of gone on some branches of that tree. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to speak to before we wrap up our conversation?
So I feel like I kind of brushed over modesty and healthy body image more than I should have. I will say that being female and growing up in a rigid modesty structure was difficult, especially because I also was an active kid. I danced a lot on various companies, and it was always this split of kind of putting my body on stage for consumption, balanced with this idea of being modest. So, and this would, you know, would be modesty clothing wise, you know, how much skin was showing, as well as not drawing attention to yourself. When you're on stage and you're using your body to perform, you're drawing attention to yourself. And so for me, I have always felt like I've had a very disconnected relationship with my body. And I think modesty was a big part of that. And with the standards of modesty that I grew up in, because it was very cut and dry, there's this drive and this need to be perfect. And because you have an actual line that you hit with modesty, if your shorts go to your knees, you've made it, you know, you've successfully hit that goal. But if they don't, then you have room for improvement. And so it's almost like this, I don't want to say OCD because that's a real condition, but it was almost this compulsive,
religious scrupulosity.
Yes.
That's a form of OCD. It's a milder form, perhaps, but yeah, religious scrupulosity.
But yeah, so I would obsess about things, and I would, and that is what drove my judgment of other people, I think, is because, you know, if I was under the pressure to hit all these certain marks, then I expected everybody else to as well. And it really impacted my relationship with my body, because I felt like it was never good enough. It was either I needed to cover it more, or I needed to be on stage performing. And so there was never really that balance of like, okay, where is my body for me? It was always for somebody else. It was always for somebody else's standards or somebody else's viewing. And so when I think about modesty and healthy body image, it's still something that I struggle with today. This idea that just because I'm wearing a tank top doesn't mean that I'm getting, that doesn't mean that I'm asking for unwanted attention, or it doesn't mean that, you know, if I have a little more arm fat, I don't need to cover it up because I shouldn't be embarrassed by that. Or, you know, I've had three children. Anyone that's had any kids knows that your belly's probably not the same as it was when you were a teenager. But like, I shouldn't be ashamed by that. I don't need to necessarily show it off in a way that I would have wanted to when I was 16, but I shouldn't be ashamed by that. And I shouldn't be constantly feeling like I have to wear something flowy or, you know, tug on it or whatever. Like I shouldn't have to constantly be at odds with my body and with my clothing. And so, it's been a really long and painful road to kind of get to that point. And I feel like, like I said, it's still something that I struggle with today. But just the recognition that my body is my own body and that I can dress for myself and not to please anyone else. And the things that I do with my body can be for my own benefit and not for anyone else has been a lesson that has taken me years and years to understand. And
okay, Josh?
Just going back to what I said about the enduring principle, the worth of all persons, if you realize that the application for yourself is that you're not going to extend yourself in ways to try to seek worth through sex, money, or power, then you shouldn't be doing that to other people, because usually when somebody's using sex, money, or power to be desirable to other people and to try to achieve worth through that, they're creating a structure where they're putting other people below them. And it becomes a hierarchy to where it's unhealthy. If you have what Brittany's saying is her body is hers and for herself, if you have a healthy view about yourself, there's no words I could say to convey the inherent worth of every and each individual, but that's something that has to come from within inside you. And if you realize that about yourself, you can realize that that's the same for other people as well. And just realizing that when it comes to sex or hormone management, sex is not, and many people take it this way, it's not a transactional thing at all. We approach it like consumerists. When it comes to being something shared between two different people, it's not consumerist at all.
I think I hear what you're saying, because we do consume sex in the United States, in Western culture. We do. It's on television. It's talked about. It's everywhere we look visually. And so we have learned that sex is a commodity and we consume it. And so then we enter into a relationship, two individuals, and it's really hard to separate that cultural message, which is it's a commodity, from the reality of what it's intended to be, which is a sharing of intimacy in a way of developing and deepening your relationship with another individual. So yeah, I get what you're saying with that. And because that's how we understand sex in Christian community, that it's deepening of intimacy, we are completely countercultural to what everyone else hears about sex and money and power. And so how do we speak more effectively to counter those cultural messages? So that leaves everybody with a deep thought, the homework for all of our listeners. How do we speak more effectively as people of faith who value worthwhile persons and responsible choices? So thanks for more questions than answers. I appreciate that as we end that. And a wonderful conversation that I think we need to have in communities of faith about how we approach modesty in all of its meanings, not just modesty that pertains to sexual proclivity, but modesty that pertains to modest income, modest behavior, modest desire that makes space for others to have as well. So thank you, Josh and Brittany Mangelson, for this discussion. And thanks to our listeners for sticking with us here on No Filter, Candid Conversations on Sex and Faith. I'm Karen Peter. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.